This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's new movies are going to be Moana, Bad Santa 2, Allied, and Rules Don't Apply. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, an interview with Morgan Spurlock about his pop-up Holy Chicken restaurant in Columbus, Ohio, which has some interesting layers to it, actually, and then the box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Like the last couple weeks, there has been a pretty slow news cycle in terms of movie news. Just a couple little ones that kind of caught my eye. Emilia Clarke is going to be in the new Han Solo movie, which is fine. It's going to be another movie where she's not going to be nearly as naked as she was in Game of Thrones. This is, I find interesting. This is a little bit of gender politics for Hollywood. There's certain actresses that got noticed for how much skin they showed. Emilia Clarke was as naked as anything could be in Game of Thrones. I've never even watched the show, and I know she's naked all the time in Game of Thrones. Once she got out of that, she's like, I'm not doing nude scenes again. And I remember Shannon Elizabeth did that back in the 90s when she did American Pie. Terrible acting. Just like one of the worst actresses on the planet in that movie. But she had giant bazookas and was naked in the movie. That's what put her on the map. And then afterwards, she refused to do nude scenes. And I mean, she had a career. She did movies, but most people are going to recognize her from the American Pie movies. So, you know, but it's going to be a Star Wars movie, which means it's coming from Disney. So ixnay on the oobs bay. The next piece of news is one of John Wick's directors, Chad Stahelski, I think is how you pronounce his name, will be taking charge of the Highlander reboot. And this ties in with another piece of news that there's going to be a Wedding Crashers sequel. Now, what do Highlander and Wedding Crashers have in common? They're both old movies. Highlander's very old. In fact, it's from the 80s. I think it was like almost exactly 30 years ago that it came out. And then they did a sequel in the 90s. And then the sequels kind of went down the toilet and they did a TV show. But this is once again another attempt to remake a property that had a certain amount of quality back then. That it's not that the Highlander story can't be redone. It's just that there's this remake frenzy that people are still trying to do, and it needs to have a good reason for it. Now, Wedding Crashers, I think, is funny because we are in the midst of there being revivals of TV shows on other networks, on like streaming networks, and sequels for movies that have been out for 10 years. You know, you've got like Bad Santa 2 that comes out this week. I'll be talking about that in a later segment. There's no reason to do a Bad Santa 2, especially this far along. Is there any reason to do a Wedding Crashers 2? I don't think so. In fact, I think a Wedding Crashers 2 might end up being kind of pathetic for these guys. They should have both moved on by now past this. But, you know, Hollywood wants to do what's been done before, even if it's been shown that doing what's been done before doesn't always work. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to play is based on a book, opens on March 31st, and it is The Zookeeper's Wife, starring Jessica Chastain.
Countries completely overrun. They're forcing Jews out of their homes. They're taking us all to the ghetto. Thousands of people are dying. The littlest of children.
We have room. We could hide them. Bring as many as you can.
I would have expected this to be an award piece. It's dealing with World War II. It's dealing with Nazis. It looks like it's an acting showcase for Jessica Chastain, but it's coming out in March, which means it's probably not Oscar caliber. We'll see what happens. But the thing I find interesting about this movie is I remember thinking a few years ago that there's a lot of movies made about World War II. There's even today. I mean, it's more than 70 years since the war ended. And you still get a lot of World War II movies. I mean, look, we even had Hacksaw Ridge just recently was a World War II movie. We got Allied this week coming out. That takes place during World War II. And I always thought it was kind of funny. I'm like, are we ever going to leave that behind? But I always said, you know, this is the thing that Hollywood always, you could always go to the Nazis as the bad guys. You always could. That you could be assured of not having to explain why the Nazis are bad and you can make them the bad guy in any movie. I mean, they even have the joke in Indiana Jones, one of the Indiana Jones movies, like Nazis. I hate these guys. But somehow in today's world, in 2016, we now need to be reminded that Nazis were and are the bad guys. And this is not politics, even. This is not right or left. You can ask anybody on the right, on the left. You can ask people, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, progressive, independent, it doesn't matter. I think most people should agree, and they would agree. Nazis are and were the bad guys. But we got to be reminded of that. People need to be reminded that that kind of thinking is not good. No one's telling you you can't think that way, but you should not be raising your kids to think that way. And it's disrespectful in the extreme to the hundreds of thousands of Americans who lost their lives in World War II fighting in the European theater to let these bastards entertain some sort of modern incarnation that's remotely acceptable. Look, the Nazis are bad guys. Changing your name or your clothes doesn't change it. And this is not right versus left. This is a moral argument. Screw these Nazis. Where's Captain America to punch Hitler in the face when you need him? Anyways, let's move on to the next trailer. The next one is Smurfs, The Lost Village, opens on April 7th.
We all know the place, the magic mushroom houses, the tight white pants.
Excuse me?
But what if there were more to the story?
2 days ago, I saw someone who looked like us.
That's impossible.
And they dropped this map.
What if they were never alone?
If there really are other Smurfs out there, we need to find them.
What if this means the Lost Village isn't a legend?
Is this safe?
We're not in Smurf Village anymore.
Wow.
This appears to be, at least from the trailer, appears to be the first Smurfs movie that takes place in Smurfland completely. The first two involved the Smurfs going into the real world, which I always felt was a misstep for Sony when it did that. It reminds me a little bit of when they did that first The Muppets, and they made Jason Segel and Amy Adams the stars, and I'm like, why don't you make The Muppets the stars? Because The Muppets are stars. Now, they did Muppets Most Wanted, and it didn't do as well. And that's a shame because the Muppets took center stage on that one. Now, the Smurfs, I'm not a big fan of the Smurfs movies. I remember watching the cartoon when I was a kid. I remember getting the little Peyo dolls as a kid. I was in fifth grade when there was sort of this explosion of popularity when I was in fifth grade. And a lot of kids had those. And I remember watching the Smurfs TV show quite a bit, actually. And I kind of liked it then. I grew out of it pretty quickly. And the first two Smurf movies, there was parts that I thought were okay, but they really stretched it by going into the real world. That was unnecessary. You didn't need that. It's like Moana, we're going to be talking about later. You don't need Moana to all of a sudden show up in real life Tahiti, because that would have been stupid. You want to keep it all within the little world. And so even though this probably looks like it's going to be similar to Trolls, which I thought was just okay, at least they're all within the same world. At least they're staying in Smurf land to do this, which I'm okay with. So, you know, who knows? It's April 7th, so it's got to be better than Angry Birds, huh? That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Allied and Bad Santa 2. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. As you can hear, I still have my Demi Moore raspy voice. My apologies to anybody who are getting way turned on by this. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be so sexy. I'm constantly having to apologize for that. But I am still getting over the remnants of a cold in my throat. But I still persevere and I go ahead. And we're going to be talking about movies. Because I can watch movies and have a cold. I can blow my nose in the movies. Sometimes movies deserve it. Let's face it. Sometimes a movie deserves it. Let's talk about a movie that may, in fact, deserve it. And that is Bad Santa 2. After falling on hard times again, an alcoholic misanthrope gets roped into another Christmas heist with a former partner who betrayed him and his own mother, whom he hates with a passion.
We got a job, Willie. I'm talking millions this time. I got an associate who's got this thing all lined up.
What's it been, 15 years?
Mom.
Well, you still hit like your daddy.
I traveled across the country to rob a charity.
You got a problem with that?
Starting to feel like Christmas.
Miserable, both of you.
Sometimes I need to be bad.
When you don't have real family, you got to make a new one. And
I know you're not the Santa, but you're still my Santa.
Confession time. I was never a big fan of the first Bad Santa movie. I never saw the appeal. My problem with the Bad Santa movie, the first one, was it just was mean-spirited. There is no funniness to it. There's no charm to it. There is no likability to the meanness. I'm all for offensive, obnoxious humor. But if there's no, like, wink and a nod, then I'm just like, well, you're just a bunch of jerks. You're a bunch of a-holes. I don't like to spend my time in the movie theater with those people. Now, they are getting the gang back together because you've got Billy Bob Thornton. You've got Tony Cox. You've got Herman Merman, or whatever the kid's name is. He's back. He's an adult now. You don't have Lauren Graham. She's not in it. I guess they couldn't pay her enough. And of course, you don't have Bernie Mac and you don't have John Ritter. They both passed away very shortly after Bad Santa came out. So it is a bit sad when you watch it because the two of them are, you're reminded that they're not just not in the movie, like Laura Graham isn't. They're no longer with us and haven't been for a long time. So take this review with a grain of salt if you're a fan of Bad Santa. Like I said, I wasn't. And so when I saw this movie, I did not particularly like it. And I did not particularly like it for the same reasons that I did not particularly like the first one. So I would imagine if you liked the first one and you like what it delivered, you're probably going to like this one. You're probably going to be like, oh yeah, he swears a lot and he urinates on things and he drinks a lot and he has inappropriate, crazy sex with different people. It's not even like I'm rooting for or against these people in the movie. Part of it is, they do things that are so extreme. There's a believability factor that I think has been blown out in both movies where they're so blatant with what they do that at no point they're caught. They're never caught. Like in this movie, one scene, Billy Bob Thornton's character goes in and he steals something from a store and he gets in the van that they're in and they drive away and the guy's running after. Chances are the guy who owns a corner store in Chicago would take the license plate, call the police, and they would very quickly be able to trace it back to them because it's the van from the place where they were working. It's not even a conceivable film to the point. I mean, if all you want to do is watch Billy Bob Thornton drink alcohol and act awful and just have no redeeming value and swear a lot, you can do that. Or you can just watch Bad Santa 1 again and save the $10.50 it's going to cost to go to the theater to see this. I don't know. I was not expecting to like this. I didn't. But like I said, in the theater, there were people laughing. But I think the people that were laughing the hardest was this family. Look at this family. They had two teenage kids that were probably about 15, 14 or 15. They had a girl and a boy with them. And the kids thought it was hilarious, probably because it was the first R-rated movie their parents took them to. If you have the sense of humor of a 12-year-old, you'll probably enjoy this movie. I just didn't. I don't see the appeal to these films. So I'm going to have to say Bad Santa 2 kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Allied. Two spies who are married are torn apart when the military tells them that his wife might be a Nazi spy.
We found each other. Come with me to London. Come with me and be my wife.
There's no easy way to say what we're about to say.
We suspect your wife is a German spy.
It's insane.
If you are right, all this will be forgotten.
But if she is,
you will execute her with your own hand. And if you do not comply, you'll be hanged.
Again with the Nazis. So it's the second Nazi movie we're talking about this week. Come on, people. Nazis are the bad guys. They're always the bad guys. Heavens to Betsy. Anyways, this movie was not screened. It was screened to some people. Like, if I lived in L.A., I probably would have seen it. But I live in Columbus, Ohio, so they didn't screen it. They made no effort whatsoever. And with a movie like this, where it's a period piece, it's got an Oscar-nominated director with it, that's Robert Zemeckis. It's got Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard in it. You would think this would get some sort of award push. And this is where, if you're a savvy enough film connoisseur, you will know by the way things are released whether it's going to be any good. And like I said, they didn't show it to me. They made no effort to show it to me. They didn't send me a screener. They didn't have a screening. And that, to me, says that they didn't think it's going to be very good. They didn't think many people are going to want to see it, and there's nothing award-worthy whatsoever about it. And a movie like this kind of needs to have some sort of award-worthiness to it to be an enjoyable film. Otherwise, you know, should they have released it at a different time? Remember The Monuments Men? That one was supposed to be an award movie, and they moved it out of that frame and put it in January or February of the following year. And it did okay, but when you saw it, you're like, yeah, that wasn't going to win anything. Or Shutter Island, Martin Scorsese film that got bumped into January. Did very well in January. Probably would have gotten lost because it was not a Wolf of Wall Street significant picture. That's the way I feel about Allied. Some of the acting in it. There's a line that Brad Pitt, I think it's in the trailer I played, that Brad Pitt says that's so unconvincing, it's jarring. And maybe they have an alternate take in the movie, but I don't know. This looks like the kind of movie that he would have done with Angelina Jolie if they were still together, or if they didn't have the absolute disaster that was By the Sea last year. Anyways, Zemeckis has come down a lot. He came on the scene with some neat stuff, with especially the Back to the Future films. And he, I think, kind of hit a hallmark and a high point with Forrest Gump in 1994, and you know, won the Academy Award for it. And ever since then, he's been trying to win that back. And some of them have been overly done with special effects, stuff like that Hitchcock homage that he did with Michelle Pfeiffer and Harrison Ford, What Lies Beneath. Or these mocap movies, or something like The Walk last year, which was great to see in IMAX, but completely boring if you weren't seeing it in a big screen in 3D. But Allied looks like it's just him puttering out. There's another director puttering out that we'll be talking about in a little bit. But first, we need to go to a break. So anyways, I got to say that, you know, Allied, they didn't show it to us, so it's a preemptive suck. I couldn't even see it.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Moana and Rules Don't Apply.
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Moana. A young Polynesian princess sails across the ocean to team up with a demigod in order to return an artifact to a sacred place.
Maui, shapeshifter, demigod of the wind and sea, I am
hero of men.
What?
It's actually Maui, shapeshifter, demigod of the wind and sea, hero of men. I interrupted from the top. Hero of men. Go. I'm not going on a mission with some little girl.
The ocean is a friend of mine.
First, we've got to go through a whole ocean of bad.
We got a little tease of this last week because I interviewed Andy Harkness, who is the director of the background and design of the film. And if you haven't heard that interview, you can hear last week's show. You can also go to the Fat Guys at the Movies website, hear the entire interview. We talk for 20 minutes, so it gets down in some of the nitty-gritty, some little more technical stuff with the animation. I'm a bit of a fascinated by animation, so I had a lot of fun talking to him. But and then when I finally saw this, before I even talk about the movie and the story, because to me, when it comes to a movie, it's a story, unless it's like a very specialized movie, like Samsara or Koi on a Scotsie, where it's not about story. But mostly it's story. Story's the most important. That's the foundation. But before I even talk about the story, the look of this film is mind-boggling. And the reason it's so amazing is because it looks real. There are times where the only reason you know it's a cartoon is the character design or caricature. Their bodies are bigger than and weirdly shaped the way whimsical characters in Disney animation are. But like when you're talking about looking at the ocean and the sea and the islands and the shore and the sand on the beaches, it kind of blows your mind. I remember when I saw Ratatouille in 2008, and I remember saying about Pixar, which is different than Disney animation, but Pixar, I said, we are at the point that when you look at certain things, you don't even recognize that it's animated. Your mind just accepts it as a real thing. And that's the way the texture and the look of this is. Now, I've been to Hawaii, so I've seen the water. And you don't believe the water is as blue as it is until you are there. And it's really breathtaking. And they nail that. And they nail the lush green of these islands. And they nail the rocky lava coast. This is a gorgeous movie. It had no story whatsoever, and you can just sit there and watch it as a travelogue for Polynesia, and it would work. But fortunately, as a movie, it also has a story to it, and it's a very charming story. It's a wonderful little story about this girl trying to find her own. I mean, it does kind of deal with similar Disney tropes we've seen before. The girl trying to chase a dream. You've got her with like some sidekick. She's got animal sidekick. She's got a pig and she's also got a crazy chicken that I think is related to Becky from Finding Dory. Cause they're both kind of not quite there. They're not playing with a full deck. And you have a supernatural element with Maui played by Dwayne Johnson doing the voice where he's a demigod and he has his hook that allows him to change form and take on some pretty nasty things. He can become a hawk. He can become a shark. It's got the humor and the sweetness. It's got music. And what's neat about the music is there was a time where it was all movies that Disney did or musicals. And then they kind of stopped having them. And he had a couple of them, which like I think Atlantis and Treasure Planet, those didn't have music, like songs to them. This one goes back to having key songs, which of course did so well for Frozen, but even a movie like Big Hero 6 was, which followed Frozen, or Wreck-It Ralph, which preceded it, these movies were not necessarily musicals. This works as a musical, and it's nice to have the music there. I still don't mind having a movie that doesn't have the music to it. I mean, Zootopia didn't have musical. I mean, it had a song or two in there, but not like this one where it has internal numbers. But it's a charming, sweet story that I think people of all ages can relate to. And it's classic Disney. It's classic Disney in the most modern format, being the digital palette. And I'm not saying that this is something that they've just done, because I think kind of from Wreck-It Ralph on, Disney Animation Studios has certainly differentiated itself from Pixar as two different brands within the same company, as having its own look, its own style, and its own software, as Andy Harkness was explaining to me. This is the ink and paint stuff with modern tools now. And it makes a great movie. So I'm going to have to say, you know, Moana is a charming, wonderful, sweet, heartwarming film. Totally worth seeing. Take your family over Thanksgiving break. Check it out. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Rules Don't Apply. Warren Beatty directs this relationship drama about one of Howard Hughes' contract actresses and her driver.
That's Marlon Mavery. She's a Baptist nun.
Amen.
You do know why Baptists think sex is bad, don't you? Because it might lead to dancing.
Maybe I'm not the right girl for this. I'm a square. A movie actress should have big bosoms and be sexy. I mean, in this town, aren't those the rules?
You're an exception. The rules don't apply to you.
If anybody working for me wants to strike up a relationship with one of our contract actresses, I have to fire him.
What's funny is I got the invitation to go see this, and I didn't know anything about it. Because when I saw it, it was several weeks ago, and it wasn't coming out right away, and I'm like, wasn't even on my radar. I'd seen the poster, and you see Lily Collin, and you see Alden Ehrenreich. You don't really see Warren Beatty, even though he's in there. I didn't even know Warren Beatty was doing movies still. I mean, what was his last movie? It was like Bullworth or something. That was like 20 years ago. And he was rapping in that one. And I guess now he's like, well, hey, let's not worry about trying to appeal to the kids. Let's do a movie about Howard Hughes. Warren Beatty does some real interesting things with this movie. It's a gorgeous looking movie. It's shot beautifully. And it captures the visual style of old Hollywood very nicely from the 50s. The biggest roadblocks of the movie are the reasons that it's kind of okay in some points. He has this weird choppy editing style in the beginning. And this is all stuff that I think Beatty put in because he's a good director. But as much as he was instrumental to making this movie work, he was also instrumental to making this movie kind of fall apart as well, because the movie doesn't know what it is. Is the movie this relationship between this woman and her driver, or is it a movie about Howard Hughes and how wacky and crazy he was near the end of his career? We don't know, because Warren Beatty can't make a decision on this. Like, the first, I'd say 30, 40 minutes of the movie is the two of them, the two kids, the Alden Ehrenreich and Lily Collins, and they're charming and adorable, and they are both easy on the eyes, and they have a good chemistry together, and they're very sweet. And then suddenly Warren Beatty shows up as Howard Hughes, and it turns into a Howard Hughes movie. Now, one of the problems with the Howard Hughes movie is that happened a long time ago. And Howard Hughes has such a long, rich, up and down life and in multiple things between real estate and aviation and movies that, I mean, it takes an entire movie to kind of digest that. And we already had that with The Aviator about 10 years ago by Martin Scorsese. So all we get is this wackadoodle guy, Howard Hughes, played by Warren Beatty. And anybody under 50 really doesn't appreciate Hughes' impact on the world. And anybody over 50 isn't going to see a lot of movies now. So I think this really only has the appeal to the much, much, much older generation, like Warren Beatty's generation. But to the modern audience, I think it's kind of lost, because they're more interested in this little love story that the movie just abandons halfway through. It's the most schizophrenic film I've seen in a long time, when that's a shame, because it had some great stuff in there. But, you know, there just wasn't room for these two young loves and Warren Beatty and Warren Beatty's ego. You just didn't have enough room for all that. So it kind of falls apart. So I'm going to have to say that rules don't apply kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking to Morgan Spurlock. I'll also talk about the box office and the home cinema roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The first thing I want to talk about in this segment is an interview with Morgan Spurlock, who's a documentarian. He did movies like Super Size Me. He had a pop-up opening of a fast food restaurant called Holy Chicken in Columbus, Ohio. It opened from last weekend, from Saturday was a grand opening, through Tuesday. So it was sort of like a test run. I had a chance to talk to Morgan. I'll deconstruct some of it, because it has an interesting little twist to it as well.
This is for the Fat Guys in the Movies radio show, so awesome. It's a good name for...
It's a great name for a great name for a show to be at Holy Chicken.
Yeah, absolutely. Give me the purpose of this restaurant, what sort of like your goal is, why you're doing it.
Yeah, well, the original idea was like, let's open up a straight, healthy fast food chain. Like, can we open up a place that has like grilled chicken and all these types of things? And the more we started researching the industry, the more we realized that people don't buy grilled chicken sandwiches. They're not popular. People don't really want to indulge in that type of fare. Fried chicken sandwiches outsell them like 90 to 10. And so we said, well, if that's what people want, how can I give people what they want while also kind of telling them why they want these things? And so that kind of became, as we started to dive deeper into the creation of Holy Chicken, that kind of became the push of, now let's sell you what you want, make you feel good about it, because ultimately at the same time, we're going to tell you how the industry works and why it works the way it does and where the food comes from, and slowly pull back the layers on whether it be the chicken business, which is, you know, kind of what we're focused on at Holy Chicken, or the marketing business of how we sell you the food that we do, which when the minute you walk into Holy Chicken, we tell you why the walls are painted the color they are, but it's like this bright orange color that's right next to us is that color because it makes us seem cheerful, youthful, and way hipper than the other fast food restaurants. We painted them green on the other side because it makes you think our food is much more natural and better for you. Those type of little cues that we're giving you and telling you what those cues mean will transform the way you look at every other fast food experience once you leave.
So you don't do any fried at all?
Oh no, we don't do the F word. We do crispy. So we have crispy. Okay. So we have crispy chicken. We have the signature grilled crispy chicken sandwich that we make in the back. We have our crunchy greens, and then we have a side of slaw. It's a very simple menu. So it's literally our signature sandwich with either a side of slaw and the crunchy greens and a beverage.
With the green color and the green message, do you go green with packaging and that as well?
Oh, yeah. That's one of our favorite things. And especially if you look at the packaging. Here's one of our brown bags. You know, you see these a lot in the industry today. You know, very simple, you know, printed brown bag. But then you read the back and we tell you we're committed to using 100% raw brown paper bags, not only because they're cheaper, but because studies have shown that these simple bags make customers more likely to believe that their fast food is healthy, artisanal, and good for the environment, even though none of those things are actually true. Holy Chicken is deceptively delicious.
Now, why Columbus, Ohio? Because we're the fattest market in the world?
I don't think that's true. I feel like Alabama or Mississippi or my home state of West Virginia is probably up there. I think we picked Columbus because, you know, Columbus is a test market, a real good test market. It's like one of the biggest test markets in America. And we looked at a few. We looked at, like, St. Louis. We looked at Kansas City. But I'd been to Columbus before. I'd shot in Columbus before, spent a ton of time here, have had great experiences every time I've been here with the people who live in Columbus. And so I said, this is where we should be. So that was kind of the driving factor. And plus, you know, if you look at what's been here before, whether it's Les Wexner, whether it's Dave Thomas, whether it's, you know, Chipotle's down the road trying a new burger experiment, you know, I think that people use this as a place because I think Columbus is very representative of America.
And this is an old Wendy's, is that right?
This is an old Wendy's. It's fantastic. We did a little exorcism to get out the spirit of Dave Thomas, you know, so we've been able to, like, get him out and, you know, reinvigorate it with the power of the Holy Chicken. And I think that, you know, moving forward, it would be great to do this in every market. You know, every market around the country, there are these dinosaurs, these shells of abandoned fast food restaurants that it would be great for us to move in there and kind of reinvigorate them with what people want.
Now, another history of Columbus question for you. In particular, you did an episode of your show where you tried to live
on minimum wage. Correct.
How does that affect how you pay your employees?
That's a great question. We pay our employees $15 an hour. It was important for us to pay people a living wage, especially where you live in a town. Columbus minimum wage right now is $8.10. That is not a livable wage. It's not even a barely manageable wage. So I think that if you really want to start to transform the industry, you need to start paying people what they're worth. And if you see our employees, like they're wearing T-shirts that say like part-time all the time, because we encourage people to ask them about their experience in the fast food industry, the previous jobs they've had where they were always cut part-time hours, like your manager would cut them off before they ever reached 30 hours, so they would never even be seen as a full-time employee and never be able to qualify for benefits or get overtime. So for us, it's important to continue to kind of cut that off and nip it in the bud when it comes to that type of a conversation.
So there's this big debate now going on, and people are saying, well, was this just a stunt? I think it's somewhere in the middle. If you listen to his interview, he's telling you exactly what he's doing. He's telling you that there's really no difference between this and any fast food restaurant because people don't want grilled chicken. People don't want healthy food. People want the stuff that they like. You know, they want fried chicken and they want crispy stuff. Is this a healthy sandwich? No. I mean, what's funny, the sandwich is good. The food they have there is actually really good. And if he does end up making this as a real restaurant and it comes back to Columbus, Ohio and it franchises out, I might go there. It's expensive, but part of the reason it's expensive, if you listen to the interview I did, he specifically was saying he's paying the people there $15 an hour. So that's part of the reason why you're paying $7 or $8 for a chicken sandwich. But then again, that's actually not that much more than getting a chicken sandwich at Wendy's. If he's trying to say, did people react and were all excited thinking they were eating healthy? I don't know if anyone in that restaurant was thinking they were eating healthy. I think people in that restaurant were like, hey, it's something new. There's a newness factor that you could never get rid of in just first 4 days of having something open. So of having to pop up for 4 days, you could serve anything. You could serve sardines in a pile of cow poop and people would probably come and buy it and maybe not eat it, but they'd buy it and they'd see what it's about because it's new. That's the way anything is when it's trendy. It's new. What's interesting is he uses the advertising and the marketing on there and he tells you exactly what it is. He read the whole thing on the bag. He's like, a brown paper bag doesn't mean it's better for you, even though you think it is, but it's not. And the bottom line is fast food is not healthy and any kind of fast food isn't healthy. McDonald's isn't healthy. Wendy's is, you should not be eating fast food. And if anything, when he did Supersize Me, if you eat McDonald's every day, it's not designed for that. You're going to hurt yourself. McDonald's is let me quickly run to McDonald's. I need to get something for lunch and come back. That's what McDonald's is. You're not supposed to eat it every day. You're certainly not supposed to eat it 3 times a day. And you shouldn't be eating fast food every day. In fact, when I was in college, I ran out of money in my account for food on campus. And so my parents send me cash. And I would just go to McDonald's or Wendy's because it was cheaper than eating on campus. And it just killed me. I mean, you're just doing that for a couple weeks. Just having, you know, one meal a day, every other day of fast food, it kills you. But, you know, even here when they give you this thing, which apparently was, you know, a meal there was probably 800 calories, which is about commiserate with, you know, Wendy's or McDonald's. But it's a good chicken sandwich. I mean, I can't get past the fact that it's a good chicken sandwich. I would go there and get the chicken. And they also had these, like, instead of fries, they had basically deep fried green beans. They don't call them fried because that's part of his in-your-face marketing. We don't say fried, we say crispy. And he like literally says that to you. But there's kind of lightly battered deep fried green beans. They're really good. If that was an option at McDonald's, I would get that. Now, are they healthy? No, they're fried. And they got batter on them. But I guarantee you that those fried green beans have more fiber and less empty carbs than a Wendy's French fry. But it's still not going to be healthy. You don't want to eat that all the time. I wouldn't call it a complete hoax, but when it comes down to it, it's still a good chicken sandwich. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office real quick. Last week, I said that Fantastic Beasts was good for $90 million.
It made $75 million. That's really good. This week, I think that Moana's pretty good for $70 to $80 million over the 5-day. It's probably only be about $45 million in the 3-day. It's the same release frame as Frozen, so I think it can build. I don't know if it's going to be as big of a hit as Frozen is, but I think it's going to be spread out very evenly over those 5 days. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Really quick, just going to rattle off a couple and then highlight two. The Mechanic Resurrected with Jason Statham. War Dogs. Hell or High Water, a really good modern Western with Jeff Bridges. And then Kubo and the Two Strings, one of my favorite movies from this year. Brilliant stop-motion animation by Leica. They are some of the masters of the industry. That is now available, and it's worth checking out. And then finally, for your Turkey Day celebration, you can get Mystery Science Theater 3000, Volume 37, which includes The Human Duplicators, Escape 2000, The Horror of Party Beach, and Invasion of the Neptune Men. Now, if you're a big fan of Mike as a host, this is weighted more on Mike. The Human Duplicators is the only one with Joel. Now, it's a pretty good one. It comes in the fourth season. Stuff like Escape 2000 comes from season 7, which is sort of that weird bridge 6 or 7 episode season when they're trying to make their movie, one of their weaker seasons. And then the other two, The Horror of Party Beach and Invasion of the Neptune Men, come from the 8th season, which is the first season of the Sci-Fi Channel run. So like I said, they're very heavy on Mike, but it leans much more towards the post-Joel influence, the post Frank Conniff influence of that run. But still, apparently these are all had not been available on VHS or DVD prior to this, unless you taped it back in the 90s. That is it. I need to go for good this week and eat some turkey. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Incarnate and Jackie. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.